What I wouldn't learn until I was older was that part of my biological family kept two of my siblings, and then three of us were put into care.
I have seen young men from the age of 5 to 16 taking care of themselves. I have witnessed my own village being obliterated, being destroyed. My own sister is still in slavery.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I'm Laura Wexler. This week on the podcast, Children Growing Up Too Soon. Two tales of kids who are forced to be adult before they're ready, or they should have to be. Before we get started, we want to thank Park School of Baltimore, an independent K through 12 progressive school in North Baltimore.
So this first storyteller, Poet Taylor.
Super amazing. Yeah. Awesome.
She's a radio DJ out of D.C. And a snappy dresser.
Yeah.
And she just commands attention in the best possible way as soon as she walks into a room. She just loves people. She's keenly interested in everyone. Just her energy was so positive and so powerful. And to then hear her share this story is a testament to humans being resilient as F.
Yeah. Take a listen.
Good evening, everybody. I am Poet Taylor. I want to thank you for coming out tonight. Before I start my story, a little back history on me. I am the youngest of 5 children, biologically, to marry an Orange Harris out of Detroit, Michigan. I just learned that March of this year when I reconnected with my biological mother on her 73rd birthday, which is another story that I have to tell you at the next storytelling event because of the one that I prepared for this evening. We ended up in care because my parents were addicts, and they left us with our sick grandmother. And my brother, Tony, was trying to make me a bottle, spilled the hot milk on him, and burnt all the skin off his arm. We were removed after that. What I wouldn't learn until I was older was that part of my biological family kept two of my siblings, and then three of us were put into care. So, my story starts when my adoptive mother, because I was adopted after being in the care, and I thought that was like the golden crown or the golden ticket, not always the case. My adoptive mother had left town. We had had a death in the family. We all couldn't go. It was altogether like 6 children. So one parent had to stay back. At the time, I had the flu. My adoptive father comes to me and he says, "You've been throwing up. You have a fever. Sleep in my room tonight because I don't want you to throw up in your sleep and you choke yourself." I am about 7 or 8. It made perfect sense to me. I don't want to die in my sleep. I don't want to throw up on my favorite My Little Pony nightgown. So why not? I woke up to my father penetrating me. And it took a moment as I laid in that bed to realize exactly what was going on. And it's funny, because even as a kid, you don't necessarily have words for what's being done to you, but you have vivid memories of things that you remember. I remember when my mother would step out the house, how he would play games with me that would end with my dress over my head and him biting my butt cheek or grabbing me on my chest. And at 7, you're thinking, maybe this is just how fathers and daughters get it in. I didn't know. When he realized that I was awake, he stopped. And I'll never forget. It's funny. Sometimes you can't remember what you wore to work. I can on Monday. But I remember the abyss playing on the TV. I remember hearing that. I remember the smell of my mother's perfume in that room. And I hopped out of bed, and I thought, where do I go? I ran downstairs to the basement. My 2 older brothers' room had been set down there to give them privacy because they were growing up. And as the irky youngest sister, I used to hide down there and scare them in the morning. I hid behind a painting all night and cried, afraid that if I said something, it would ruin my family. And was it even wrong what he was doing? Because I didn't know. Why else would he be doing it? The next morning, I go right into the flow of things. I pretend like I was down there to scare my brother, and I avoid my father at all costs. My mom comes home like a day and a half later, and I had contemplated, because when you're in care, I was in foster care, and all I kept hearing was, you don't want to be the bad child, and you keep getting kicked out of homes. So I grappled with telling her what had transpired. And then finally, I was like, she loves me, and I'm a teller. My God. I told her, and she made me feel like She would protect me from everything. She told me she couldn't believe that he touched me. How dare he? She cuddled me and she kissed me. And she thanked God that it wasn't worse. And she said, I'm going to handle this right now. I was like, yeah, man, go kick his ass. Yeah. Man. About 30 minutes later, she called me upstairs, called me to her room. And I walked in there like, we about to handle him. Yeah, he can't touch me no more. He was sitting in his recliner chair, and she turned to him and she said, did you touch that? I know you didn't touch that, because that's what she's saying. And he looked me in my face and he laughed and he said, why would I touch that? And she made me strip in front of him and gave me a beating, and I'll never forget it, because this time she wrapped the bottom of the belt around her hand and she hit me with the buckle part. To this day, on this side of my chest, there's the imprint of that buckle. I look at it every morning. It's faded over the years, but I look at it every morning and I'm reminded of that moment. And as I stood there and she beat me and he looked at me and she laughed, I thought, my God, I will never share this story again. And after that, whenever he wanted to come into my room, whenever he wanted to touch me somewhere in the house, he got to. Now, eventually my adoptive parents would break up. And I'm thinking, great, she cheated on him. You a pedophile, I'm out. When she left, she took her biological children. By now, my brother and sister who were adopted with me had gone. She said, I never wanted to adopt you. And you see what he wanted to adopt you for, and she left me with him. So now we're in D.C., and I'm going to Lincoln Junior High School and then eventually Dunbar, and I am at home cooking, and when my father wants to come in my room, he can, and I gotta go and not act like anything's wrong, because I remember the last time that I told, nobody cared. By this time, I'm going to church, because I kept hearing how God would save you. He'd never forsake you. He'd never leave you. I'm leaving praise and worship service, and by now, I'm like 11, 12. I'm like, God is gonna rescue me, and in a game of truth or dare with the pastor's daughter's daughter, it comes out that my father's been touching me. And I'm like, this is now going to be when I am rescued from this hell that I call everyday life. I'm marching to the pastor's office. She's told him what happened. I'm ready. The pastor sits behind his desk, and I'm like, okay. By now, my father's a deacon at this church, so I'm scared of now what this will do. And he says, you know, sometimes when little girls are mad at their daddy, they make up stories. I can't believe that one of my great deacons would be doing anything remotely close like that to you. A part of me died that day. I wanted all of me to die that night, and I was not successful. And then it was a woman at the church. We went to church like 2 Sundays later, and she said, I heard something, and I just want to talk to you about it. And I laid all my issues at her feet. From the beginning to the end. By the end of church, he had been approached by other people in the church. He runs, and now I'm just left in D.C. Now I'm in an emergency group home where I meet girls with stories that I never even fathomed, that mirrored mine, matched mine, and I'm thinking, my God, it's this many of us? And now, because I'm not a cute baby anymore, and now I'm about to hit 13, I'm not wanted by foster homes, and the group home counselors think that I'm going to bring all kind of issues to them. And I was just like, well, here we are. I ran away so much that the police were giving me birthday cards. I used to think that was so lame, and then I realized that's somebody caring about you and wanting to leave you something so that even in those moments you think you're not cared about, you are. I have a family court judge, and after coming, I got locked up for stabbing somebody with a fork. Then I got in trouble for doing this. She was like, I want to take you out of where you are, and hopefully if I place you somewhere else, you'll be better. And I thought, well, I don't know what's better than these group homes and all this living I'm having now, but I'm here for it. I moved to Baltimore County in my first foster home. I'm like, I'm ready for this. My first night there, the nephew of the woman whose home this is says, hey, let me put you on to something. When I come in your room, don't say nothing. Don't fight it. You can tell my aunt. She ain't gonna care. She know all y'all got issues and y'all fast anyway. And I was like, What kind of introduction? What? Wait. Thought he was joking. He was serious. He tested that theory that night. And for the year and some change that I lived there. And I didn't know who to tell. My social worker was in D.C. He hadn't came to check on me. And I'm just in this situation. And now I'm now beefing with the other girl in my house because she thinks that what he's doing to us is some kind of love. And I'm impeding upon her relationship. We eventually get into it. We have one of them bad situations where the police are called. And anybody who's been in care, you know we got two options. We either go into a juvenile detention center or we going to fake like we hear voices because we know the next step is you're going to make me talk to a doctor at the hospital. Let me tell you now, very young, you earn how to manipulate the system so that you don't end up somewhere you don't want to because you feel like nobody's listening to you anyway. I end up in Shepherd Pratt. There's a counselor there that says, you're not crazy. What's really going on with you? And we talk. And by this point, I'm on suicide watch because in my mind, I have absolutely nothing to live for. And I believe that God is a joke because you told me you'd never leave me or forsake me, but here I sit. I was transferred to a Baltimore foster care agency, PSI. Get this guy named Alan Stewart. And he's like, I believe in you and love you and see you even if you don't believe in yourself. And I told him, yeah, okay, sir, whatever. I said, all right. He said, I got a home lined up for you. Your life's about to change. And I was like, yeah. Got out, and I met Patricia and George Taylor. What do you say to the people who picked you up at your lowest and made you love yourself in a way that you never even thought was imaginable? For every foster parent in the room, thank you for rolling the dice and loving a child that's not yours unconditional. I walked into my mother's house. We were talking about it earlier today while I was driving here. She said, you walked in there with your arms folded. Well, when you gonna kick me out then? She loves to imitate me, but she don't do me like I do me. When you gonna kick me out then? When you gonna kick me out then? Because I know I ain't gonna be here long. She was like, you was a handful. You know what my mother told me? I love you. And when you're ready to receive all this love that we got, come sit at the table. I would skip dinner, sat in my room. And then the more she just, hey, I love you, have a good day. I ain't talking to that lady. I don't know this lady. I don't know what she doing. My father, George Taylor, hey, you need anything? You want to go? No, I ain't going with y'all. Nah, nah, nah. And slowly, because by now words meant absolutely nothing to me. You were either going to show me or not at all. And I was trying to plot my escape. There were two problems. The house was a mile from the bus stop. Chick wasn't walking there. And I really wasn't sure where I was to know where I was going. So I was kind of stuck. And I think that was God's divine intervention. Because in that home, my God, there's no way I'd be standing on this stage having this conversation if my mother wouldn't have diligently poured into me. And when I opened myself up to her, I learned that she only took teenagers with issues because we normally sit in group homes for years and age out into absolutely nothing. Or we have a social worker who has so much on her plate that when this foster kid, me, scores 14 points away from a perfect score on her GED, I got expelled from all the high schools in D.C. and Baltimore. But that's another story for another stoop tour. I'm telling y'all, that didn't want to see me go to college because it meant she'd have to keep my file for like another 4 years. It was my mother, Patricia, that was like, well, they don't want to help you. We're putting you in this apartment at 17. You fail, you're coming home, and we'll figure out what you don't know. Fast forward to me now. In all the nights that there were people touching me and doing things, and I felt like dying was so much easier than breathing. As I got closer to God, I would have these conversations where I don't need to be rich. I don't need to be famous. I want to be able to have a platform that allows me to be a voice that I didn't have. I want to be the ears and listen twice as hard as I speak for those kids who have told their story over and over and over again and had people tell them they were lying and they weren't worth me to even look into it. I wanted to be that person. So every day when I pod that mic at PGC, I'm reminded of my steps and that unfortunately there are people that hear my voice that are dealing with it, growing out of it, trying to figure out how they're going to make their way through. And I'm thankful that God wants to use me as a beacon to shine that light to home. For the people of Presley Ridge, you may not ever know how you impact and what it is that you do. I'm talking from the administrative assistant to the social worker. I am a walking testimony of your work and that it works when the village is willing to work together. George and Patricia Taylor are in here. My mother has a swollen knee. My father has a cough. And y'all still showed up for me as usual. I love y'all. Earlier, we talked about what happens when your bio is not there. For those not in the know, bio is biological family, but sometimes you don't want to say the whole word. So to that I say, to those that step in the place of sisters not there, like my sister Dina, to the unofficial godmothers like Miss Georgia, who take those friends of your kids' friends under your wing and you feed them and you clothe them and you nurture them, you fostering and don't even know that you fostering. So go ahead and sign up now because we need you. And if you take nothing else away from this evening, from me even hitting this stage, you are seen, you are heard, you are not here by accident. If you're standing in this space, in this moment, there's work for you to do that you're going to pour seeds into that you won't even be alive to see people reap the benefits. That's just the way this works. Thank you.
So Poet shared her story at an evening of storytelling that we did with an organization called Presley Ridge, and they provide services to children and families in foster care. And in particular, lots of the stories were about the support that Presley Ridge offers kids who are about to age out of foster care. And yeah. That is such a difficult transition because literally the day you turn 18, they just cut you off.
Yeah.
The state cuts you off. And if you don't have a plan, you're really, really going to be in trouble. And so many kids are as they age out of care. And so if you want to hear more stories, you can go to our website and look on the page of the story for Presley Ridge. And they'll just be these stories, like you said, resilience, just like the resilience that these I find myself, particularly in this moment where things seem really hard for many people I know and the world, I am so struck and inspired and fortified truly by these stories of resilience.
And thank goodness that organizations like Presley Ridge exist. So you can find out more about them as well.
Yeah.
So we also want to thank, before we move forward, our sponsor, Golden West, which is a vegan-forward restaurant located on the Avenue in Hamden since 1997.
And Baltimore Magazine, which you can find at baltimoremagazine.com or on the newsstand. And you can check out Local Flavor Live, which is their podcast about the local food scene. This next storyteller is Jacob Atem. And speaking of resilience, he is resilient as F. He is from South Sudan and was one of the original lost boys of Sudan who walked thousands of miles in search of safety. He was resettled in the U.S. He grew up weirdly in Michigan in high school there, did high school there, did college, did a master's degree, did a PhD, came to Baltimore to do a postdoc at Hopkins Bloomberg, and now is the CEO and founder of a South Sudan healthcare organization. So he's going to share a story that really begins with, I think, something we all as parents recognize, which is the difficulty of explaining some of our life experiences to our children. So take a listen to the story from Jacob.
So last month in October, I was getting ready for a PowerPoint presentation in Michigan. So I put my five-year-old son and the Sammy upstairs. And I came, and I was just doing my PowerPoint presentation. I was so focused on my computer. You guys understand when you do PowerPoint. Literally, did I know that my five-year-old son, Sammy, snuck behind me, didn't see him at all. And as Sammy was looking at my computer, he zoomed into this picture. And right away he said, "Daddy, I don't like that picture." I don't know about you, but as a parent, when you got caught off guard you don't know what to say. And quickly, I was speechless for the first time. If you know me, I'm never speechless. I was speechless, and I had to be honest, like scramble around. What should I tell my son? I'm like, first of all, you're not supposed to be here. Why are you here now? Go upstairs. And as I pushed my son away, because I really had no idea what to tell him, after he went upstairs, I start weeping. I start crying. Here's why I'm crying. This picture that I was putting on is a picture of a child facing down, very malnourished, literally it's a skeleton, but behind is a vulture is watching. I hope some of you are familiar with this picture. It's a well-known picture. And it reminds me of my old past. It reminds me of old wounds. And the reason I cry and weep is that I could be that child. This picture is so famous. It was an award-winning photo. A gentleman by name Carter went to Sudan and took that picture. It was an incredible picture. When he came here, he won all the award you could imagine. Carter ended up killing himself. He committed a suicide. And because my son was asking so many questions, the first thing he said, I don't like that picture. Why is that big bird standing there? And then he quickly said, what happened to the child? The same question, why Carter killed himself, is the same question why my five-year-old son was asking me. The reason I cry is as me as a victim, I was really challenged by my son. What do I tell him now? I was just 2 years older than Sammy. I was about 7 years old when the war in the Sudan between the North and the South happened. That's why I cried. I had seen a lot of atrocities. I have seen young men from the age of 5 to 16 taking care of themselves. I have witnessed my own village being obliterated, being destroyed. My own sister is still in slavery. As my cousin taking care of me, ended up drinking my own urine, ended up finding a safety and walking 3 to 4 months to Ethiopia. And again, continue to find safety to walk another 3 to 4 months to a country called Kenya. The reason I ended up crying is this photo reminded me of the thing that I should never have gone through as a child. I have seen a lot when I was so young, I would go blind temporarily. I couldn't see in a refugee camp. I would go blind. But let me brag a little bit about the generous people in this world. Most of you heard about the Lost Boys of Sudan. It was in 1998, and I don't want to be emotional today, but I want to, this is a full circle come around. When we first got to Kakuma refugee camp, it was Ibn Paul Spiegel. I didn't know him back then. He was first medical epidemiologist receiving us. He has seen that, and I have so much respect for you, the humanitarian workers. Literally, did I know that I would be fortunate to be given a refugee status to be resettled in the United States of America? I spent 9 years in a refugee camp. Let me just put it this way. You're waiting for your death. It's a big grave. You are hopeless. Forget about the future. And if you've been there, either visit or live there, you understand what I'm talking about. But there are some generous people in this world. When they allowed the Lost Boys, 3,889 Lost Boys and Girls to be resettled in the United States of America, I was the fortunate one. I was an unaccompanied minor. I was under the age of 15. I was brought to Lansing, Michigan. And by the way, barely speak English. And I was brought to Michigan. And I was like, could you just take me to a hotter place? Why are you taking me to Michigan? I mean, we have Florida, we have California, but of course, they're taking me to Michigan. When they said it's snow as white, I had no idea. What the heck are they talking about? And especially when they said Hakuna Matata, and I'm like, oh, I understand that. That's Kiswahili. Let me just put it this way. It was so difficult to adjust to American culture. The first time I was in a formal education, in fact, I started learning about Shakespeare. I didn't know. First of all, let's start. I didn't have eighth grade education, let alone Shakespeare, be aware of Macbeth. And all those, you know, English people, you people understand. But life was so difficult, to be quite honest. But I want you to think of this. For the first time in my life as a refugee, I was able to think right. I told myself, I am one of the few. What can I do? And I dedicate myself to work hard, graduate with my high school diploma, went to college and played soccer, and I co-found Southern Sudan Healthcare Organization to help my people back home, the village that was destroyed. And I went and worked hard to finish my PhD. And most importantly, I'm going to go with Dean McKenzie. Yes, I will brag about Johns Hopkins. You know why? Because a refugee was able to do a postdoc at Johns Hopkins University. I will tell you that. I'm not ashamed of it. And if you would have asked me in Kakuma refugee camp that I would do a postdoc at Johns Hopkins University, I would have said, you are such a liar. I'm telling you all this, that I was one of the fortunate. Let me tell you about the American I know. Let me tell you about the American that brought me here. The reason I was here with my fellow Lost Boys is both the Democrat and the Republican actually got together with a bipartisan bill to allow me here. Let me repeat that again. Maybe you didn't hear this. The Democrat and the Republican got together on a bipartisan bill to bring me here. This is important. I'm not into politics, but this is important. Bipartisan meaning they agree together. I got a homework for you. Yeah, get them to get agreed now. Yeah. This is the America I know. Now, Paul Spiegel, who was helping me back then, I have joined him and many other thousands of humanitarian workers. I'm not a victim anymore. I want to contribute. You see, what I need was not money. What I need was opportunity. People like my foster mom who give me that. People who like Paul and others who give me that. I didn't ask for money, and this is why I give back now. Let me tell you about the America I can brag about it. Some of you who work in a humanitarian setting, just hearing your story, Nancy, is scary. It makes you still go back. You're a little bit crazy to go back. And if you are in humanitarian, it's very scary. Let me tell you, a few years ago, I was caught in a civil war again in South Sudan to the point that I almost lost my life. But let me brag about the America I know. I was naturalized citizen in 2009. For some of you, thank you. For some of you, you like, what is that? That's when you take an American test. And it's the hardest test, by the way. Okay? I was naturalized citizen in 2009. Went back, doing my humanitarian work, got caught there. Guess what? Men and women in uniform took off from Djibouti to come and rescue me. I reflect on that. 3 to 4 Americans were injured. Think about this. A refugee come here and a naturalized citizen being rescued by the American military. And they actually was injured in the midst of rescuing me. That is the America I will tell you about it. That's the America that don't discriminate. And I'm so grateful that I'm in this place today called United States of America that give us the opportunity Go back to the story I told you about the picture. The reason I will keep crying and actually be sad is that there may not be more opportunity for people like Jacob who may come here, have opportunity to come here and go back either to South Sudan and help. You know why? Because that picture is still continuing today. There are more lost boys in South Sudan. There are more lost boys in Syria. Paul, you just say you came back from Colombia. There's more lost boys being produced. And these people need our help. And this is why I do what I do, whether it's in South Sudan or whether in any other part of the world, to advocate for the refugees who are like me, who just come here proud as an American and be able to make the difference. Thank you so much for listening, and may God bless you.
Funny too.
He is so funny, and he loves our country. And that was a part of the story that I think
it's so interesting, right? Yeah. It's interesting as someone who's born and grown up here to hear a lot of the stories that were shared at this show that Jacob was at. Were immigrants who were talking about their gratitude and their love for America. It's such an interesting moment to have that. Hold that, and then also our own disappointment with the ways in which our country isn't fulfilling
which
its
speaks
promise.
To a lot of the aspects of privilege and, you know, just awareness of space and safety. And his recurring line of "Let me tell you about the America I know" was really invigorated the room. We also want to thank Wine Source, which is located on the Elm in Hamden in Baltimore. It's a great place to go to get any sort of beer, wine, snacks, that kind of thing.
You can find out about all of our upcoming events at stoopstorytelling.com. Please leave us a review wherever you get your podcast content. And we want to thank Maureen Harvey for editing out all of our mistakes.
Her immense patience with us.
Thank and producing Maureen. The podcast. We will see you next week. Sports host and father, 'cause he took her mother.